If you've heard much of my preaching over the last few years, and some of you have been masochistic enough to hear quite a lot of it for a decade or so, you will have probably noticed me being quite critical of a lot of Christian thinking about sacrifice. I've repeatedly said that the way that many Christians have interpreted the death of Jesus as a sacrifice for our sins is a blasphemy that casts God as a bloodthirsty monster and conflicts fundamentally with the teachings of Jesus himself. You will have probably heard me quoting Jesus, who was in turn quoting the prophets, saying that God desires mercy, not sacrifice. But tonight we heard the Apostle Paul urging us to present our bodies as living sacrifices, holy and acceptable to God, and saying that such sacrifice is the right way to worship God. So if God desires mercy, not sacrifice, what is Paul talking about? Has he got it wrong? And has our liturgy got it wrong? Because each week we offer prayers over the bread and wine around this table, and we say to God, "Here we offer and present to you ourselves, our bodies, minds, and spirits, to be a holy and continuous sacrifice to you." The prayer is obviously echoing the words that we heard tonight from the apostle. But how can they be right if Jesus says that God desires mercy, not sacrifice? And to further confuse the question, we have all sorts of religious extremists running around at the moment talking about holy sacrifices as they inflict terror and bloodshed on the rest of the world. And then we have nations like ours talking about the sacrifice made by our military personnel who are fighting against those same extremists. How are we to sort out this sacrifice business and make some sort of useful sense out of it? It seems to me that much of the confusion arises from overlooking the fact that the Bible and our religious traditions speak of several quite different kinds of sacrifice. And if we lump them all in together and confuse them with one another, we end up in all sorts of mess. Even in the biblical laws around the offering of sacrifices in the old Hebrew temple, there was a multitude of different sacrifices with different requirements and different meanings. Some involved the shedding of blood, others didn't. Some were about seeking forgiveness for sin, others were about expressing gratitude, others were about making vows or dedications. The slaughtering and burning of an animal on an altar to atone for sin is obviously the biggest and most dramatic one, so it gets all the attention, but that attention can blind us to the important fact that it is only one among many. I'm not going to go through and catalogue the sacrifices in the Hebrew Bible tonight, interesting though that might be. Instead, I want to draw your attention to three broad categories of sacrifice that are of great relevance in the way that we talk about sacrifice today and in the way that we treat one another in today's world. These three are quite different from each other. The first type that I want to highlight is penal sacrifice, which is all about dealing with sin. It views sin as an offence against God or against the gods, and it sees the offence as something that incurs a penalty which must be paid before normal life can be resumed. If the penalty is not paid, then the gods are likely to punish us in a range of other ways. And you can see how this understanding underpins all sorts of things that we see and hear every day. It underpins most of our penal system. Those who have committed crimes are seen as owing a debt to society or incurring a penalty that must be paid before they can return to normal life. even if they are completely repentant and reformed and of no further threat to the community, most of us still feel that the penalty must be paid. The punishment must be endured. A devastating hurricane has slammed into the coast of Texas overnight, and you can be quite sure that there will be angry preachers who will announce that the hurricane is God's angry judgment on a nation that has refused to face up to its sin and to put their trust in the right sacrifice. Only when we turn to God and pay the price demanded can the anger of God be appeased and the nation kept safe, they say. The biggest problem with this model of sacrifice is that it assumes that God is just like the pagan gods, angry and vengeful and violent, and that God can be bought off with a payment of blood. This is precisely what Jesus is challenging about the temple sacrificial system when he quoted the prophet saying God wants mercy, not sacrifice, and that God's love is generous and universal and does not need to be bought. But despite his own critique of such ideas, a lot of Christian theology has tried to squeeze Jesus into the old system by suggesting that the death of Jesus is itself a blood sacrifice to appease an angry and hostile God. The second form of sacrifice that I want to talk about also existed within the ancient Hebrew system of religious sacrifices, but it's perhaps even more common among us today. I'm going to call this the purging sacrifice. In the purging sacrifice, we seek to deal with evil and sin by correctly identifying its source and then purging or expelling it from our midst. Now, you can probably think of numerous laws and stories from the old Hebrew Bible that talk about the importance of either expelling or executing the one who has defiled the community by bringing sin into its midst. With executions, this category of sacrifice overlaps with the previous category a bit because the death can be seen as both a purging of evil and as an offering to appease the angry God. In its basic form, though, we see it in the Hebrew sacrificial ritual from which we get the word scapegoat. On the Day of Atonement, the priest would ritually transfer responsibility for the sins of the people onto a goat, and then the goat would be driven out from the people into the wilderness, never to return. This thus was the people's evil purged from their midst. The goat was sacrificed by driving it off, leaving the nation with its purity restored and thus acceptable to God again. This idea that we can be made pure by purging the evil from our midst inevitably gets tied up with identifying the evil with a particular people who therefore need to be expelled from among us. Among the Hebrew people, this then got bound up with the expectations of the Messiah, who would be the one who would wield the sword and drive out the evildoers. So when Peter identified Jesus as the Messiah in the gospel reading that we heard tonight, it's probable that the reason that Jesus told him to keep that opinion quiet was that he knew that Peter could not yet separate the idea of a Messiah from a violent crusader who would drive out the Romans. And he didn't want to encourage Messiah talk until the disciples had reimagined what that meant. The instinct to purify ourselves by purging our community of the evil other is horribly apparent in any number of burning current issues in our community. And you can usually see it on both sides. Groups like the One Nation Party and the United Patriots will invoke racial or religious differences as evidence of an evil that threatens our community, and they will advocate a purge. We need to build walls, strengthen borders, turn back boats, ban burkas, and expel potential suspects. Only by banishing the threat can our lives and our culture be kept safe, they say. But the same instinct is equally apparent among their opponents. And we easily find ourselves looking for ways of silencing or expelling those whose views we find so abhorrent. Like Hillary Clinton with her basket of deplorables attitude, we purge them from our concept of our community and regard them as an alien presence whose anxieties and whose welfare have no claim on our compassion or attention. And as Hillary found out, our very desire to purge them from our midst deepens their anger and gives them a clear common enemy to unite against. The same-sex marriage debate that is currently raging here in Australia is frequently marked by the same polarisation, as each side sees the other as an abhorrence that needs to be silenced and purged from our midst before it infects us with its poison. It's often expressed in explicitly religious terms by those who oppose same-sex marriage because they see it as a Trojan horse that is literally bringing a whole range of moral toxins into our community to destroy everything we hold dear. It must be expelled, they say, and nothing is too heavy-handed or too rude in the face of such threats. Thus, many of us were shocked by the Archbishop's implied threat to sack employees of the Catholic education system who marry same-sex partners. And I was shocked to hear that on a suburban hockey field yesterday, at the end of a game involving my daughter's team, who wear a rainbow sleeve on their hockey shirts, when her captain went to thank the referee at the end of the game, the referee said, "Well, I just have to tell you why I will be voting no," and proceeded to give her an uninvited lecture. All she was trying to do was thank the referee for having done a good job of refereeing the game. But the trouble is that, as a supporter of same-sex marriage, I have been just as shocked by some of the atrocious and equally aggressive behaviour that has often characterised those on my own side of the debate. I guess we didn't set that table up very well. We too have demanded that people we disagree with be dismissed from their jobs or have their names removed from sports stadiums or literally or metaphorically be run out of town. I know gay people who don't support the idea of same-sex marriage because they regard it as an alien heteronormative construct being forced upon them, who are now afraid to say so because no dissent, however nuanced, is currently to be allowed in their community. I totally accept that hate speech should be silenced because it can literally kill. But I'm horrified when I find myself instinctively wanting to resort to the same tactics as my opponents, to vilify and shame and purge my world of that which I don't like. I also know that although such purging sacrifices seek to create peace within our group by ridding it of divisive differences and by uniting us against common enemy who is now on the outside, it never actually works. The truth is that when we try to unify a group by eliminating the differences, it actually leads to increasing conflict. Because the more alike we become, the more we are offended by increasingly minor differences, and the purge goes on again. That's precisely why the Apostle Paul went on to tell us in the same passage we heard tonight that we need to recognise that the different members of the body all have different functions. If we all want to be the same, we'll be torn apart by rivalries and conflicts. Peace will be found in learning to honour one another with our differences, not by seeking to purge every error or evil from our midst. Jesus was a constant critic of the practices of seeking religious purity by expelling and excluding those who could be deemed to be a threat to it. So if neither penal sacrifice nor purging sacrifice meet the Jesus sniff test, does it smell like Jesus? What is it that Paul is talking about when he calls us as followers of Jesus to offer our bodies as living sacrifices, holy and acceptable to God? Well, the most immediate obvious difference here is that the sacrifice he is calling you to offer is you, yourself. It's not about identifying someone else who should be sacrificed. This is self-sacrifice. It is about setting aside your own personal desires in order to seek the good of others, the good of the whole. You know what this looks like in your personal relationships. Often the good of the relationship is best served by relinquishing a personal preference in order to find a pathway that is mutually beneficial. Jesus calls us to do this on the larger stage as well. He calls us to take up our cross and to follow him in pouring out our lives for the life of the world. Sometimes that just means giving up selfish things that weren't that good for you anyway. But sometimes it can be seriously costly. And as Jesus showed, it can even extend to giving up your life for others. That may look like a physical risking of your life to protect or rescue others from harm. Or it may look like losing the love and respect of friends or family because you refused to participate in their crusades to purge the world of their hated evil other. Try standing strongly against the vilification of opponents from either side of the same-sex marriage debate, and you'll very likely see what I mean. But this pattern of self-sacrifice seeks peace not by eliminating the other, but by creating space in which the other might be shown grace and hospitality and love. When Jesus called us to love our enemies, he didn't say that we could be excused from that if our enemies said mean-spirited things that we found hurtful. Now, I do have to acknowledge that the idea of self-sacrifice can also mutate into something dangerous and ungodly, especially if it is combined with a crusade for a purging sacrifice. The religious extremists who blow themselves up or get themselves killed trying to purge the world of the evils they abhor show how this happens. But there's no hint of that in the words of Paul or Jesus. The religious and political leaders who had Jesus executed clearly saw his execution as a purging sacrifice. They were eliminating what they saw as a dangerous threat from the midst of the community. Much Christian theology since then has tried to fit the death of Jesus into a penal sacrifice mindset and see his death as buying our forgiveness by paying the penalty demanded by an offended and angry God. But you won't find any support for such views in the words or teachings of Jesus himself. He consistently described God as a loving Father who is only too willing to forgive and who welcomes us with open and loving arms. And all the evidence of the Jesus stories suggests that he saw his own death as simply the inevitable self-sacrificial consequence of standing up for the victims against a powerful, self-interested system that was constantly sacrificing them and alienating them from the love of God. Thus, the Apostle Paul calls his followers to offer... the Apostle Paul calls us to offer ourselves as living sacrifices. He follows that with his call to not be conformed to this world. This is not a change of topic. We can either conform to the ways that our societies construct themselves around the rejection and sacrifice of others, or we can, as Paul says, be transformed by the renewing of our minds according to the mind of Jesus, the way of Jesus. And as we watch the world tearing itself apart around us, perhaps it is increasingly obvious that the self-sacrificing way of Jesus is not just some utopian dream for wide-eyed idealists, but is actually the last and only hope for a world that is sacrificing itself to death. So, brothers and sisters, in the words of Paul, present your bodies as living sacrifices to God, and do not be conformed to the sacrificial madness of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds, so that you may discern what is the will of God, what is good, what is acceptable, what is perfect.